Arm's Length Reporting, for investors who want the whole story. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, welcome in. KER Politics. I'm chatting with a published author right now. His name is Josh Melville. Josh has written a book called The American Time Bomb. Very, very interesting. Josh, take a couple of minutes, if you would. Just give us a brief overview of your book, and then we'll get into some specific issues, okay?
Sure, sure. First, thanks for having me on your show.
It's a pleasure, Joshua. Thank you for coming on.
My book is the fifth book of mine that's been published, or is it the sixth? Actually, I've lost count. And it's the first book that's about my father and me personally. It's half biography of my father, who was a very famous radical from the 1960s, who bombed about a dozen buildings in protest of U.S. imperialism mm-hmm. and America's involvement in the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And the other half of the book is kind of my own memoir of my mission throughout the late 1980s and 1990s to find out the truth about what he did and did not do and the circumstances surrounding his death, which was that the famous Attica prison uprising in 1971.
Yeah, I understand he was killed there. That's a bummer. I'm sorry you had to go through that. I really am. Tell us a little bit, if you would, how this book relates to what's going on in America today, would you? I mean, we got a lot of violence going on in America today.
Yes, the book is one of the reasons that I wrote this book now and not, 15 years ago, was because I saw what was happening in America since the 2016 election cycle. And what I saw were direct parallels to things that were happening in the late 1960s with kind of Trump becoming the new Nixon and BLM replacing the Black Panthers and Antifa replacing the Weather Underground. So I saw a lot of direct parallels, and I thought now is probably the best time to tell my father's story because it's relevant again for the first time in, roughly 50 years.
I got to tell you, Josh, I find it to be incredibly relevant. Now, I personally, as our listeners are aware, and we have a blog associated with our radio show, and we have upwards of 200 comments on the blog virtually for every show that we do, sometimes as many as 500. My listeners are very, very concerned about the violence that's occurring in our country today. Tell us how your book describes that violence and the parallels, would you, bud?
Sure. Well, I wouldn't say it describes the violence per se. What it does is describes the profiles of the people who commit the violence and their motivations for becoming radicalized. And my theory is definitely revisionist at the least, in that what I began to realize by talking to many of the radicals who were in my father's cell and friends who knew my father and just doing tons of research about my father is that many of the people who commit these acts have found a fashionable outlet for their rage, which is usually in a political form. But if that fashionable outlet did not exist, most of these people would by and large still commit violent acts.
Can you explain that? Can you explain that to me, please?
Sure. So one of the questions I try to wrestle with in the book is, was my father a true believer or just, a deadbeat dad who had found an outlet for his rage, through the counterculture, rise of the counterculture in the 1960s. So, in the 1980s, if you decided to, quit your job as a well-paid plumbing engineer working for a prestigious architectural company and leave your wife and kids and go underground to throw bombs, people would be like, what? Why are you doing that? What's that
right.
about?
Right.
But there was a period in time in 1969 when that was okay to do, when that was cool. And that has resurfaced again in the post-2016 America.
Well, Josh, let me tell you, I'm an interesting guy in the sense that, and I don't mean to talk about myself, but believe it or not, this is going to be very relevant to your book. I'm pretty conservative, okay? And my radio show, as you know, as your publicist has told you, is also a very conservative show. Now, Given that fact, my personal political leanings in the 60s that you're talking about, my only disappointment in the 60s was purely and simply that I felt that America had lost an awful lot of its moral value, for lack of better terms. Do you think that's the case in America today?
Well, you know, I hate to use the word moral because it's so subjective.
Okay.
I do think we've lost the ability to be critical thinkers, and we've lost the ability to debate our differences civilly. And I think that was that existed in the 60s as well, but it's even worse today. I think social media and the fact that how should I describe it? Very fast-paced editing, ultraviolet films have created kind of a short attention span theater for the average person. And it's made it very difficult for us in the age of outrage to just discuss our differences politely and civilly. In the 60s, it wasn't quite as bad, but it was bad. And, you know, proof of that is that the fact that a number of well-educated pacifists took to violence by bombing buildings and attempting to commit acts of extreme violence against the military.
Well, it's certainly going on right now. There's no, I mean, the only difference today is I don't see very much action contrary to the military today, but I see an awful lot of action, destructive action, for lack of better terms, towards society in general. Why the difference, Josh?
Why the difference between the 60s and today?
Yep.
I think a lot of it is social media. It's almost the obligation of the youth to rebel against the older generation. That's part of their function in our society. And the millennials today make up percentage-wise more of the population than baby boomers did in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have a generation, that larger group of people whose job it is to be rebellious, but you're living in a time when everything is very prosperous. America was very, very, well, it still is very, very prosperous. It's not like that there was no war to rally around. There was no significant social causes to rally around. And so I feel that the millennial generation, whose job it is to keep the older generation in check, or at least for a while at least, they've latched on to causes that I think to people over 50 seem kind of frivolous and less important than the social causes that the new left had adopted in the late 1960s.
I find that to be pretty interesting. I'd like you to elaborate a little bit, if you would, on the basic tenet that you made dealing with social media being a cause of this. Can you talk about that a little bit? We've got about 2 minutes, then we have to take a break, and I'll bring you back after the break.
Sure. So social media combines the worst elements of two important forms of communication. It combines the permanency of the written word with the spontaneousness of the spoken word. And this is probably a dangerous cocktail. Most people are not great writers. Most people can speak impulsively. And there are things that we used to say to one another, probably face-to-face or at a party, that once said would dissolve into the ether. But because of social media, they're permanent. And they create an atmosphere where that seems to bring out the worst in most people. People don't seem to be able to be civil on social media. I think it's easier to be rude to someone when you don't have to face them, when you're hiding behind some kind of avatar or an account with a fake name on it. I've noticed that the people on social media that are the most outspoken and the most vitriolic often don't have their photograph on their social media account.
No, and that's very true. Josh, I hate to interrupt you, but I'm going to have to do it. We've got to take a real quick commercial break so the stations can make a living, for lack of better terms. But we'll be back on the air here in about 30 seconds. Joshua Melville, thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.